Hi, I'm Tim Orr, the DP of Dickinson, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions, and this is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals and filmmakers. Today, we discuss the Apple TV Plus hit show Dickinson with director of photography, Tim Orr. The Go Creative Show is supported by Hedge, Shutterstock, Rule Boston Camera, and Premium Beat. Well, the past few weeks have been insane. Absolutely insane. We've had amazing, amazing guests. It's been one hell of a month, I'll tell you that. It started off with Lawrence Scherr, the director of photography for Joker. We had Richard Rutkowski from Castle Rock. Marshall Adams, the director of photography for El Camino and Better Call Saul. And last week, we had Robert Eggers and Jaron Blaschke, the director and cinematographer for The Lighthouse. Oh, we had Ryan Connolly from Film Riot, too. It's been crazy the past few weeks. Absolutely crazy. And we have all of you guys to thank. Now, if you've been listening for the past few weeks, you've noticed that we often have questions from our audience on the show. And it's a great way to have your voice heard and get a little shout out on the show. And it's easy. You just follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Follow us at Go Creative Show. And whenever we have upcoming guests, we give you guys an opportunity to ask a question. So that's been a great way to have your voice heard. And we love doing that. So please follow us there so we can continue. But we've got a hell of a show today. Apple TV Plus just launched earlier this week. And one of the shows that everybody's been talking about is Dickinson. And for good reason. It's a great show. It looks really cool. And there's an interesting story behind it. And we're going to get to the bottom of it with Tim Orr coming up in just a couple of minutes. But before we get there, I want to talk about Hedge. Yes, Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. It's super fast. I was going to say asked. I guess it can be asked too, but it's definitely fast. And it gives you an opportunity to import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations at the same time. So think about this. You're on set. You're getting media cards from everybody, camera operators, audio techs, behind-the-scenes photographers, and God knows who else is on there. And it's your job to make sure everything is backed up correctly. Hedge is going to do this for you the right way, the best way. Before I was using Hedge, I was dragging files all over the Finder. And if you're doing that right now, then you really should be paying attention to this ad because Hedge is going to change your life. It's going to change your workflow. And media is the most important asset we have as, you know, people in the production industry. Our media is our currency. This is what we do. So you don't want to just drag it all over the Finder like an animal. No, you need to use professional software. And that's what Hedge is. So you can import multiple sources. You have them right there on the left-hand column. Send it to multiple destinations right there on the right-hand column. Press transfer. And that's it. You just wait. And the best thing is it's even faster than the Finder most of the time. And when the transfer is done, it's going to send you an update on your phone if you have the Hedge Connect app, which I do and I love. So I know when the transfer is done. It's a no-brainer, people. Head over to hedge.video/go-creative-show. You get 20% off the full license, but there are also other licenses there too if you want to just try it out for yourself first. And there is so much going on. They're always updating the app, and I cannot be more happy with what these people have been doing. In the short time that we've been working with them, they've made incredible advancements. So they're always updating the app, and that's one of the many reasons why we love Hedge. So check it out for yourself at hedge.video/go-creative-show. All right, let's get to our interview because there's so much to cover with Tim Orr, the director of photography for Dickinson. So I'm here with Tim Orr, the director of photography for Dickinson, and a whole bunch of other stuff that we're absolutely going to get to. Tim, thank you so much for being on.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, how is it working with Apple TV? You are one of the first shows that are going to be premiering on November 1st, and this is a big deal for Apple. It's a, you know, it's a big deal for the industry, and interesting to see them jumping into this game. Kind of late in the game in a way, but love to hear your thoughts on the whole thing.
We were one of the first shows to go into production when Apple jumped in the game and to get into the entertainment and, you know, streaming business. And, you know, they have such a great reputation as a brilliant company.
Oh, yeah.
That you just knew that this is going to be really cool. And it's been fantastic. We were, you know, it's difficult when you're, it can be difficult when you're getting at something new with like a new, you know, network. We can network or company that's entering a new venture.
Yeah.
But they really built a very solid team, you know, from kind of top to bottom, you know, from the, you know, all the producers, you know, the way Apple is run in terms of their entertainment division, it was, you know, we were supported fully and 100%. And one of the great things going into it is that, you know, part of their, you know, mission is to kind of support storytellers and creative storytellers. And that's certainly something that, you know, we felt every step of the way.
You know, when they first announced that they were doing Apple TV Plus, I was sort of like before they even mentioned any shows or anything, I was thinking like, I was a little bit turned off by the idea that they were going into something so huge, because it just up until this point hasn't been what they did. And it was around the time when people were saying, you know, Apple's abandoned the pro community, and it was just kind of this odd change in direction for them. But the more I'm thinking about it, and now seeing Dickinson and a couple other shows, the quality is really high and the storytelling's really good. And it's like, I'm thinking to myself, like you just said, they've always been committed. Apple, that is, has always been committed to helping people tell stories and helping people be creative. And this is just kind of another outlet. This and Apple Arcade, it's nothing different from their original mission of giving people, you know, the tools and the outlet to be creative. They're just doing it at a really high-end level now. And but it is all in the same realm.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, like when you really think about it, they're a company that's built on being the best, whether it be making, you know, the best products, whether it be computers, phones, what have you. But also, like, you know, when they entered into this game, they really wanted to be the best at it. Yep. And, you know, and I think it really shows in the quality of the, you know, like, I haven't seen the other shows yet, but I know it shows in the quality of our show.
Yeah. I mean, yours looks like a really nice big budget is what it seems like to me. You've got stars, you got really good looking sets, great storytelling, cinematography's excellent. Like, how was it, you know, from a budget standpoint, did you feel like you had everything you needed?
Oh yeah. You know, this is an impeccably produced show, and everything that I needed as a cinematographer in terms of tools to do the job properly in the way it should be realized, you know, I've gotten everything I've asked for and everything I've needed. And we have a schedule that is forgiving enough to where we have enough time to do things right. Mm. Oftentimes in, you know, this business, you can really be faced with not enough time to properly pull off what you're endeavoring to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and like, I think we've all been in those situations, and of course you figure it out. And in this one, I won't say it's luxurious, because, you know, they kind of never are, but we definitely have enough time to do this right. And, you know, and I think everyone realized that that's really important.
Early on, people were saying that Apple was being really strict about the content and making sure that it adheres to a certain, you know, like guideline of rules and all of that. What I'm seeing as I'm watching a couple of the first and second episodes of these shows is I don't really see that. Like, you know, the shows are very unique. They get into all sorts of different subject matter. If there are a set of rules, it doesn't seem like anybody is adhering to them. and I'm just curious, like, is that just a rumor? Is there any truth to that?
I think that that's just a rumor. I never heard anything, you know, when I heard those same rumors out there and was like, really? Well, that doesn't apply to what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know? So no, it's like there hasn't been, to my knowledge, no like rules or regulations of like, you know, you can't do this. We don't want, you know, this to be portrayed. It's like, it's been, from my perspective, a vast amount of creative freedom.
Yeah. I mean, episode one, sex, lesbianism, smoking cigarettes, defying your family. It's like,
they're all there.
Yeah, exactly. All the ingredients of a really good show. But like, yeah, I mean, I don't know why that was out there, but people were talking about it. I think it probably could have been some Apple trolling, just trying to make people, you know, down it from the beginning. But it's not what I'm seeing. And it's nice to hear that you didn't feel that way on your end either.
Oh, yeah, no, not at all. I mean, that's why I was really surprised. I was like, really? You know, I hope that's not going on with any other shows, but it certainly didn't go on with ours.
Tell me about the show. What is the show about for the people that haven't seen it yet? And just so you know, we are releasing this after November 1st. So people will be able to go and check out. I don't know how many they're launching with. I don't know if they're just doing one or two or the whole season, but this will be...
They're doing the entire season.
Oh, perfect.
I believe it's one of the few Apple shows to initially launch where all 10 episodes are going to drop at the same time.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, great. Yeah. So far what I've been able to see is the first two episodes, but by the time this episode comes out, you guys listening, you can go and watch the whole thing. So, but just kind of briefly tell us, what is the show about?
Well, it's about Emily Dickinson, who was betrayed, brilliantly by Hailee Steinfeld. And this is, it's a different take of Emily Dickinson than I think that, most movies or shows have, you know, that have been released prior have been about. This is about young Emily Dickinson and the brilliant poet and her family life and her, you know, and her friends and their relationships, love, conflict, you know, at the time, women's place in society. And it's a really kind of modern take on, you know, mid-19th century New England. Mm.
Yeah, I love the way you guys blend that modern feel. And in all like the press leading up to, you know, its release, I had heard that it was blending this kind of modern take on the old-time New England and wondering how you guys were going to do it. And I think it was done so well. Let's kind of dive into that first, because we are portraying a certain time period, but the performances and the, you know, maybe it's even some of the cinematography, it all kind of feels new. Talk to me about how you're achieving that.
Well, when I first got involved in this project, one of the goal was to not make it like a typical period piece. And I think that, oftentimes you can, you know, you see these, you know, these films or shows that are set in, you know, like an era that was maybe 150, 200 years ago. And they seem remote. Mm-hmm. And because it's kind of like, we didn't want this to be like you're looking at a painting. We wanted this kind of be that you feel relevant and fresh and modern. And, you know, like a lot of it is there in the script, from the writing, in terms of intent, you know, like this is, you could feel like that Emily and her friends, are dropped into today's culture in terms of like the way they speak, what they talk about, like their, you know, like their concerns of, you know, within their lives at the moment. And, so it really resonates. And so there's more of a connection than there kind of usually is going into, you know, something that could feel antiquated. Mm. And so the, approach visually really wanted to shoot this in a modern contemporary style and with, you know, with energy, you know, with a certain boldness, not just, you know, to where it's like the viewer would fall asleep. You know, this is you know, some kinetic filmmaking at times. And then there are times when you kind of know when to, you know, settle down with the style and not overpower the text or the performances.
Yeah, I think let's talk specifically about maybe the camera package you chose and why you chose that for Dickinson.
Sure. I tested three different cameras going into this. Of course, like with Apple, they adopted a very similar guidelines in terms of delivery, much like Netflix does, in terms of having a 4K acquisition requirement. Yeah. And so at the time, and usually when I shoot digital, I use Alexa for the most part. I'd used other cameras, other digital cameras in the past for different reasons, but, you know, Alexa was kind of a go-to camera for me. But of course, at the time, and now they'd had the LF camera come out, and I did test that. Along with Sony Venice and the Panavision Millennium DXL2. And since I couldn't use a regular Alexa and the Mini LF had not come out yet, my concern with the Alexa LF was it's just really big and it's kind of heavy. It's a great camera. It looks beautiful. But I didn't feel like I had reservations about it really fitting some of the style of the show, because I knew we were going to be moving the camera a lot. There was going to be, and with a variety of style, some handheld, some, certainly Steadicam, we do a bit of everything. Mm. After I tested these cameras, I really liked the Panavision DXL camera. It really produced a beautiful image, great skin tones. Really, the build quality of the camera is excellent. I took all the images through a final color correct within my test involved, and I was really happy with the DXL. And I think the other cameras perform wonderfully too. The DXL just felt right for this project in terms of look. And we record 8K, which is great. So, it's a big, beautiful image that is future proofed. Part of the look also is the lenses. And, I'm using, Primo 70 large format, lenses that are detuned, which, Panavision has some different recipes that you can detune lenses to kind of give them different qualities that, are not just kind of like out of the box, super clean glass. So I'm using what's called a Noir 3 detuning, and which is really fantastic because this show, like especially when you're dealing with a modern digital cameras and it's a big sensor, and with modern lenses, I didn't want to use vintage lenses on this because it just didn't, because of the contemporary look was really kind of going for with this. But that said, it's like you do need to soften the image up, and that requires using diffusion. And the drawback with using diffusion in front of the lens would be, this is a show. Mid-19th century, anything that's not, it's natural light or it's candles, lanterns, and fire.
Yeah.
And so you would get like, it would be really difficult to shoot as much candlelight as we shoot in this show with diffusion in front of the lens. So with the...
Why though? What would happen?
Whenever you put a layer of glass in front of the lens, a lot of the times you can get like haloing around, some of the sources, or worse, flares that are kind of like they become like artifacts, and it's like where the bright highlight kicks off of the back of the filter and reflects, to the front of the lens, and so it kind of creates a little bit of a double image of the source.
So in that little bit of an air gap, there's some reflections and flares and things like that.
Exactly. And it's like, and you can get it with bright skies. Sometimes, you can kind of see it around, like, say if someone's head is in, against a really bright, window or a really bright sky, if, you're using, depending on what diffusion you're using in front of the lens, You can see it if you know what you're looking at. And, you know, that's the type of thing I always like to, you know, have diffusion be invisible. You know, that it's, you know, I think it certainly has its place in it, at times, but most of the time you kind of, you don't want people to kind of, you don't want to pull anyone out of the story. So the lens detuning is fantastic because and especially to the level I'm using it, it really kind of softens the image and it produces beautiful, like silky skin tones. But I don't have to use diffusion in front of the lens. I will occasionally, on some close-ups, use a light diffusion for some close-ups, but I'd say 95% of the time I don't need to.
Do you know what it is that they're, like, when you say detune, are they putting, like, any, are they affecting the glass? Or, like, what is it that's happening?
They're affecting the glass. So it's like there are different recipes that produce different effects. Okay. And you know, essentially, in this one, they're creating little dimples, little like microscopic dimples in the some of the elements of the inner glass, which produces an effect. It's kind of like it scatters and smooths the light out. And when it's done and you can, you know, and it's done in, at least with this recipe, it's in five different grades, one being the lightest, five being the heaviest. I tested all of them, but really kind of found that three, like kind of in the middle was like ideal for this project. And there are different, you know, some of the other, lens detuning recipes, they do produce different effects, some more subtle, some, you know, very specific and stylized. None of the others really felt right for this. I like the noir because it keeps the blacks rich. And a lot of times when you're using diffusion or some of the lens detunings, it can lower the contrast. And that's something I didn't want to do. I wanted to keep nice, rich, thick blacks, but soften the image and be able to produce really beautiful skin tones.
And are you doing that like right there at Panavision, or are they giving you lenses to go test, you know, on set, or how does it work?
Yeah. So I've worked with Panavision for a long, long time. They are just fantastic. They've always supported me, you know, throughout my career. And, you know, I will go to the camera house and they would set me up with a selection of lenses, you know, basically kind of like I would ask for, a few different specific recipes, and then I would, which they prepare in house. You know, they do the lens detuning, you know, in the rental house. And then I usually just, sometimes you can kind of take them out in the field, but for these tests, I was mainly interested in very low light, how the camera responded to. Very low light, shooting at really low light levels.
Yeah.
Because I knew that there would be times, and there are times where we have to shoot, because of the nature of the shot for these night interiors, that I have to shoot with like a real lantern or just a candle. That's something that, you know, you really need to test and know how far you can go. And, you know, otherwise you can get yourself in real trouble, you know, in terms of like having, cause we, you know, I don't want a grainy, murky, noisy image, you know, I'm trying to maintain throughout like a really, thick negative, you know, as it, you know, when it, you kind of go back to film terms, to where it's like, it's still well exposed even in low light.
Yeah. The blacks are deep, but you can get a lot of, you see a lot of character in them. And in the low light scenes, the candlelit scenes, it's clean. It's super, super clean. Now, obviously, I'm sure in color grade, they're doing a little bit of post work on it, but still, no matter what, you got to have, the raw image itself has to be pretty damn clean to get it that clean. I was really impressed with that.
A lot of the times when, you know, because this show, I would say with some exceptions where I have to really rely on you know, what I would call the key light or the predominant light source to be an actual practical. Most of the time, you know, it's augmented with, you know, lighting, you know, like movie lighting. Most, you know, every scene is. And so for really low light scenes, you know, they can be tricky. And a lot of the time what I will do is overexpose it and then just print it down. On set, you know, my DIT darken it, you know, so that I'm not already in a place to where it's really, really, you know, at the low end of the, in the toe of the exposure.
Sure.
So it's like, it's still a little more comfortable in terms, it makes it for color grading, you have room to, you can go anywhere, you know? So that's something I certainly protect for.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called A Warm Festive Feeling by Sean Frierson. The holiday season is upon us. It really is. And I know you guys are working on your holiday-themed videos. Who isn't? And Premium Beat is where you need to go to find that perfect holiday track. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music. They've got a collection of thousands of songs there for as low as $49 each. And you don't just get the individual track, you get cutdowns and loop sets and stems. What that really means is full customization to make the track fit your project perfectly. So head over to premiumbeat.com for this song or one of the thousands of others and see how the perfect track can elevate your project. Premiumbeat.com. And lastly, let's talk about Shutterstock.com. You know, Shutterstock is where we all go. You go, I go, everybody goes for their royalty-free images and videos. But it can be overwhelming when you have to search through 270 million images or 16 million video clips. It's insanity what they have over there. So Shutterstock has become extremely focused on making the discovery process as intuitive and easy and customized to you as possible. And that's why they've launched a brand new upgraded intelligent homepage. Now, this is exclusively for logged in accounts, so you have to have an account to experience this, but it's worth setting up an account if you don't have one already, because it's going to enhance your ability to find that perfect image. The discovery process is super important to them, and they're always striving to make it better. And these are three areas in which they are doing that. One, it's a more personalized homepage. Two, they do monthly curated collections, which are awesome. And three, they have improved interaction with your account history. So your intelligent homepage is influenced heavily by your past purchases. So it's one of a million reasons why Shutterstock is the place to go for royalty-free images, videos, music, and more. Check it out for yourself at Shutterstock.com. Let's talk about the lighting a little bit more. Like we said, I mean, we're in a time period where we are not going to have the incandescent lights. So it's going to be candlelight. It's going to be daylight. Lanterns, things like that. You're still trying to maintain this kind of modern feel and look, but what I noticed is that it seems like all the light sources are very true to what they would be, or at least they appear to be that way. Talk to me about that challenge and how you overcome it.
Yeah, sure. It's, you know, one of the things is, even though this show is, it's breaking the mold in terms of what you expect for the period in terms of its style and, tone. But one thing that's really important, I feel, and we really kind of talked about this in prep before we, you know, started shooting, is that it should be grounded in a certain realism. You know, this should feel naturalistic and real. And there are times, of course, there's some, you know, fairly fantastic sequences that, you know, we kind of certainly push and, stray a bit from what you could, you know, say is like naturalistic lighting. But everything has to be motivated, you know, and when that is motivated by, you know, for the right reasons, then we go there. But for the most part, it's like it really wants to feel like you can step into one of these rooms and it's like, oh, yeah, this is the way this would have been. You know, this is the way this would have felt. This is the way people may look. And of course, it's so, you know, I motivate the lighting from what, the sources of candles, lanterns, mainly. It's all a very warm palette. I try to make it feel, you know, rich and luxurious and very pretty. And, you know, shoot this more like a drama, even though it's kind of billed as a comedy. I certainly shoot it like a drama.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so it's very straightforward in that way. Pretty much everything is lit. It's just that you know, the trick is making it look like it's not.
So what are you using? Are you in there with LED panels or are you in there with like,
So predominantly like, you know, the day stuff is a little different, but for the, you know, the night work, I'm predominantly using, light mats, which are small, very lightweight, LED, fixtures that, you know, they come in, you know, like multiple sizes, but I usually use about three different sizes. Some are, you know, like probably, 2 feet by 1 feet, you know, 2 by 1. And then the other ones are like 4 by 3. And you can kind of, they're great because they're lightweight. You can kind of hang them, you know, anywhere, hide, you know, the smaller ones you can hide, very easily. It's a soft source. And I usually also then add further diffusion, in front of the instrument. And I'll also use, these Astera tubes. Which are amazing because they are, you know, what you would, they would kind of look like fluorescent tubes, like in the, you know, 4 foot standard fluorescent tubes, but these are, RGB, with any color you want. Like they've got like the entire, like a, you know, gel book, you know, programmed into the software, and they're battery operated. So you don't have to deal with cable. And there are times where we've done some shots where it's like we have to go through the entire house and, you know, figuring out where you can put things to, you know, kind of light the scene and light the shot can be really tricky. These things are fantastic because they save you so much time in terms of you can put them virtually anywhere, easy to hide, great light quality, but no cable. And you can do cues on the fly. Like there are several times where it's like, you know, say you're doing a walk and talk and you have to, you know, do like a bit of a pan in the shot to where it's like what was a backlight is now a front light, but I don't want the front light. So it's like, you know, while the camera is panning, you can have, you know, controlled from an iPad, you know, the ability to basically take that light out.
It really is incredible. I love those Astera tubes. We've used them a lot. And the cool thing too is that yes, you can hide them easily, but if you want to show them, they look great. They look great practicals.
Yeah, fantastic. On other shows, you know, like that are more contemporary to where it's like it's kind of more modern lighting. It's great to play with the color. You can, you know, like you they, yeah, put them in shot, you know, for like kind of architectural uses.
Yeah.
They're beautiful.
Have you used the light ribbon? I'm guessing light mat, you were using like the official term, the light gear, light mats.
Yes.
Have you used the light ribbon? Their other product. What do you think of those?
Oh, it's great. I mean, it's just so, you know, it's like in the last, 10, 12 years, you know, LED has certainly revolutionized film lighting. You know, it's made, there's so many great products in terms of like the, you know, the ease of, the way it works, what color you can, you know, selecting a color, is, you know, so much easier, and it just that added flexibility is amazing. But you know, with the light ribbons, it's great because you can truly put anywhere. And I don't need to use it as much on this show just because of...
It's good for like futuristic type stuff. Yeah. Like even on their site, they have a lot of sets that look like the insides of spaceships and things like mm-hmm. that. It's cool. I mean, it's definitely cool. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, guys, so you can check it out. But it's Light Gear, LITEGEAR. And they've got their three products there, the ribbon, the mat, and the tile, which I've never seen before, but looks like...
The tiles are great. They're really bright. Like if you need to light a bigger space, usually the times I've used it is for a top light, for a very low profile, bright top light. They're awesome. Hmm.
So you kind of have two different looks in this show. You have like the real world that Emily Dickinson lives in and the cast lives in, but then you also have this like death world, where they go into this old cryptic looking carriage. And what I noticed just watching the first two episodes is when we are in that world, the cinematography is cleaner, the light is sharper, the sources feel a little bit harder, even though we're still primarily candlelit, but everything feels a little crisper in those scenes. Am I just imagining that, or is that something that's really going on? And if so, why?
Well, you know, it's like you're definitely taking a step out of her reality and into her, and truly into her imagination. And especially with our death character, who is super cool.
Yeah.
I felt like this was an opportunity to stray from the, what I would call our normal look of the show. And it is a little sharper and a little cleaner hopefully in a subtle way.
Yeah.
Some of that comes out of also the set that we shot, you know, for this death's carriage. Some of it has to do with kind of like color contrast. But one of the things that was great about this is that I could stray a little bit from what the real color of, say, candlelight is, you know, like the warm kind of flame motivated color temperature.
Yeah.
So, and I actually used inside the carriage, it was a Steratubes only.
Ah.
And so then I kind of chose a little bit more amber color. And so, and especially it's like with Emily's dress and with the color of her dress and with the color of the set, which was had a lot of like deep, greeny blues, turquoise, kind of very rich. That color contrast really kind of adds to some of that sharpness. And it's a place in the show that we don't get as much of that as you would maybe normally have.
It's really beautiful. I loved it. I thought it was very, very cool. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of her imagination and it feels a little bit more modern, even though clearly the set design is still of the period. But you introduced this really great red color in there. You got a lot of moonlight that has like kind of a coolness to it. And even the candlelights, I'm looking at stills right now. The candles are not as warm as they are in her home and in her real world. They're a little bit cooler. And it's just such a great looking set. And actually on that note, is it a set? I mean, how are you guys shooting that carriage?
Yeah, that was there's a carriage that we use for exteriors that we don't shoot in at all. All the interior carriage scenes were done on a set. Mm. So there was like a little, carriage build that is the true to size, true to scale of what our carriage we use for exterior shots. But you know, we could pull it apart, of course, and which was important. And you know, you could do, we just kind of put it on little airbags and away we go.
Pull it apart how? What do you mean?
We wouldn't have room with the cameras to be able to like kind of shoot it as a true practical space.
Sure.
So, it was built to where we could remove both ends and even the side, you know, so we could pull the side off to get like an exaggerated wide angle say two shot of two people's, you know, the Death and Emily sitting across from each other. And then of course pull each in so that, you know, we don't have to be physically inside the carriage because we couldn't have achieved some of the shots that we wanted to achieve without being able to do that.
Did you also kind of extend the section behind the seats back a little bit? And the reason I ask is, as I'm looking at this, and I noticed it when I watched it too, but now looking at stills, you've got shallow depth of field. Like, and if this was truly just a regular carriage, the seats are like right up against the back wall. And I'm like, they would have been crisp if you didn't have extra room.
Yeah, there's a little extra room, but not a lot. You know, a lot of that's due to, you know, with the,
you just have really just fast lenses
field. Yeah. It's like, it's, you know, I was shooting wide open and with the very large sensor size, it really, you know, the depth of field is like very, very shallow. And it's of course hell on the focus pullers sometimes.
Yeah.
But they're fantastic. They've, you know, done a great job. And, so it allows us to, you know, to be able to do that because it's like, you know, that stuff's in that impressionistic kind of quality of shallow depth of field is just super beautiful. And it's something that, especially in that world, you know, I felt like it was important.
Talk to me about your relationship with the production designer. I mean, a show like this, period piece, it's got very strong production design. And, you know, I'm assuming there has to be quite a bit of communication between the two of you to make sure that the materials and the sets and the props.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, talk to me about that.
Yeah. Lauren Weeks was the production designer. He just did a fantastic job. And, you know, of course, it's like, you know, a lot of the times when a cinematographer comes onto a project, you know, the production designers start much earlier than the cinematographer. And, you know, there are times when, of course, you know, like locations are already chosen. And in this case, the principal exterior location already was chosen. I didn't get to scout the exterior when the choice was made where we shot. We shoot the exteriors, most of the exteriors, not all, but most of the exteriors in this historical restoration village in Long Island.
Oh, cool.
And it's kind of like a great backlot for us because it's all period, you know, buildings, you know, houses and, you know, like blacksmith shops and church, you know, a chapel and a town square. There are no power lines anywhere. So it really feels like you're kind of dropped into, you know, mid 19th century. It's perfect for us. So I didn't get to scout that because of when I came onto the project, but, because they really had to make a decision about that, you know, early on.
Sure.
But I did arrive prior to sets being built, and it was a great collaboration in terms of like really, you know, we would go over every, you know, wallpaper, every you know, the carpet, you know, the upholstery for furnishings, is certainly kind of like different colors, what color should be used where. That was a really important collaboration to kind of get the balance of the rooms right and to where it's like the, you know, because we're in these rooms a lot, in the Dickinson homestead, it's like, you're there a lot of the time in these shows, and it's like, and they really have to be interesting. And thankfully, due to the era, the Victorian era, there was some kooky stuff they did. I mean, in terms of decorating their houses, especially people that were, you know, had the money to do it. And that, you know, Dickinsons were they were well off. They did some kind of almost, well, one of the things that we kind of wanted this to be a little bit was psychedelic. You know, and so with some of the wallpaper, especially, it's just crazy. You know, it's beautiful, but it's like, but you know, the thing is, they really, that's a lot of the stuff they really used in that era is kind of like amazing. But you know, it really was great to be able to work that closely with the designer. And I think it makes a big difference. And especially also the costume designer, John Dunn was the costume designer, a very similar relationship in terms of, you know, balancing the color against the sets and, you know, what would photograph well in those environments.
Yeah, I'm looking at the sets, you know, watching it, and I'm thinking, oh my God, everything on set is like custom made to take your attention away from where it should be. But for some reason, just the way you guys, you know, frame your shots, light, the costume design, you are still very much paying attention to the characters. And those are busy sets. It's one thing to do, you know, modern day. You can have an all white kitchen, throw anybody in the middle of the frame and you're looking at them. But here, everything is fighting for your attention. It's incredible.
And there were some things that we, you know, like, for instance, there was some carpet that, you know, I was reluctant to. I thought this is too far, you know. So there are those times where it's kind of like, you know, the contrast, and it was, you know, for the dining room, which isn't so beautiful, but. You know, there are times when you really have to know, like, to show some restraint to where it's like it won't tip the scale of, like, taking the viewer, like, kind of, because you don't really want them to think about it. You know, there's that momentary kind of, you know, that momentary sense of, like, wow, that's really cool. That's a striking room. But then hopefully it's like you appreciate that, but you're right back in the story, you know, because, you know, certainly everything we do is, you know, like the creative keys is to support the storytelling, you know, and that's certainly something we don't want to overwhelm.
What were your references for this?
You know, it's interesting. David Green, who I collaborated with for many years, and we've, you know, done a lot of stuff together. He invited me on to this project. He did the first block, the first two episodes. And, you know, since this was a show that we really wanted to be different, this is a show that kind of, it wasn't about, we didn't have any really specific references. We basically, it was more about what we didn't want to do, you know? So it became, you know, like, oh, well, we don't want it to be, and I'm not going to necessarily call out certain thing. I'll just kind of use like a generality. You know, we didn't want this to be a typical period piece. So it's like, there wasn't like a real firm template for, you know, oh, it really should be kind of like this. We just kind of talked about like what we wanted to do with the camera and, you know, have it be a very active participant. And then kind of knowing, you know, that the show, in terms of its look, in terms of its lighting, wanted to be grounded in a certain naturalism. There weren't easy references that we wanted to, we kind of wanted to make our own.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because period piece, you would think immediately you'd be pulling references, but it kind of makes sense, because you said right at the very beginning of our conversation that you were trying to avoid the things that make it feel overtly period, because it still needed to be modern.
Yeah, that's why we didn't really kind of rely on other, you know, films or shows from, you know, that are set in this era, because we were approaching it like it was, you know, like a much more modern take in a much more, you know, modern world. It just happened to be set within a certain realism of, you know, the mid 19th century. Because you'll see that in the set, you know, the set design is very, you know, realistic, and it's very true to period, even though some of it seems kind of crazy. It really was. And the same thing with costumes. So we're really embedding ourselves in those, you know, in production design, costume design, cinematography, in, you know, that certain realism, but the way we actually execute it in terms of the style with camera and in certain places with some of the fantasy, we definitely kind of stray from what you would expect.
Let's take a quick break and talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. All of it. And I'm there all the time because I have my production company here in Massachusetts, and Rule is right there in Boston, hence the name, Rule Boston Camera. And the crazy thing is the big, huge Hollywood films that come through our area, they all use Rule. Yeah, they do, because Rule has an insane inventory. Insane. It's huge. Huge world-class inventory. I mean, they've been in business for over 30 years now, over 35 years now. So you can only imagine what they have there in their warehouse. So a world-class inventory. But what really makes them stand out is their service. You know, production is mission critical. Every moment is worth money. And you want to make sure that you have a production partner with you. And that's what Rule is all about. You don't just grab your equipment and go and that's the end of it. No, they are committed to making sure that your project goes off without a hitch. You know, they're going to give you expert advice and counsel during pre-production. They're going to give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out on your shoot. And they are committed to supporting you throughout the entire length of your project. So we're talking about peace of mind. We're talking about a partnership. And that's what you get with Rule. So experience it for yourself over at rule.com, RULE.com. All right, there's still so much more to get to. So let's get to it. The conclusion of our interview with Tim Orr, Director of Photography for Dickinson. Can you point to a particular scene or shot that was particularly challenging on Dickinson? Something that, you know, you learned a big lesson from, or sure, there's got to be something over the course of the 10 episodes that really stuck with you.
Well, let's see. There have been a few. There's a couple. One is actually very simple. It can sometimes it's like a very simple. What is a simple shot can be not easy to achieve, and to make it look the way it really needs to look. Right. And so one was like, this in the first episode with, you know, Emily's cleaning up after dinner in the kitchen. And due to the way we wanted to shoot that in this one shot, you see most all of the room.
Yeah.
And she can only be lit by. So there's no. And also she's basically cleaning up and then she goes over and blows the candles out. And so. To create the right level of light in the room to where you can still see her.
After the candle goes out, you're saying?
After the candle goes out.
Yeah.
You know, but without having it feel like it's lit that way, you know, that there's more moonlight in the kitchen or ambient night, you know, light than there should be, was, you know, kind of tricky, you know? So it's like that was a place to where it's like it to get that right. To me, it's like one of the hardest things to do in cinematography, to do well, I should say, is realistic, no light, light, where there's not really any light in the room. You know, it's moon. It's what we call, you know, we have, especially in this kind of world, there's no, there's no streetlights, right? There's no, no real porch light that you can kind of motivate like something coming in. It's like, and so, you know, we have to rely on that. Movie moonlight, and to make it feel really realistic and dark enough is kind of can be a tricky thing. So it turned out well, but that was a shot that was harder to execute than what you'd normally think it would be to make it look right. And then there's one other that was in a later episode we do like a very long walk and talk that spanned all the way through the bottom floor of the house, and then out the house, across the yard, over to the barn, that really wanted to be done in like, you know, part of it was one shot. And then, you know, the other part where you had to break into, I asked to break into two for a specific reason, but, you know, like, so it was tricky lighting, you know, it's always tricky lighting those shots in terms of like those big long walk and talks that's going through in some cases, a very small space. And again, have it feel like realistic, you know? So that was a bit tricky, but the trickiest part became for the exterior because, you know, I'm the only DP on this show. And so sometimes I don't get to scout, or a lot of the times I don't get to scout with the new directors.
Oh, wow. So you did all 10.
Yeah, I did all 10. Yeah.
And do you like that? Or do you like kind of having
I do like that. I mean, I don't know that I would like it all the time. For certain shows, I kind of wouldn't like it. But for this, I really feel a certain kind of visual authorship of it. And I really kind of like that I do all of them. It, you know, it feels like, you know, it's the cinematographer, you know, say, hey, this is my show, you know, in terms of, you know, having a hand in building the look, you know. But the downside is that sometimes I don't get to scout. And it's like in this particular, you know, it's a situation where due to when we needed to shoot that scene, the light was, it became like a front lit situation. And that's something I always try to avoid, you know, it's a very, fairly simple rule. Most of the time you want to keep the light behind people.
Yeah.
You know? That was one where it became tricky to make when we did enter front light to make it look right. And, it was one of those lessons that the lesson I took away from that was try to be there to scout when if you can, because I certainly would have, you know, campaigned to do it a different way. Luckily, you know, I talked to the director and said, you know what? I think we should shoot behind them for half of this shot and then kind of go in front of them. It'll look a lot better. Trust me. And that's what happened. And so I became very happy with what could have been a very difficult situation to make something look good.
I love stories like that. It's always shots that you just, you know, there's going to be, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the time it's not the ones that you'd think are that hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it can be a fairly simple, it's like, God, why is this so difficult? You know, so.
You've worked on a lot of really nice stuff, and I certainly encourage you guys to check out Tim's IMDb, but I've got to ask you what it's like working with Paul Reubens. You did Pee-wee's Big Holiday, the Netflix film. I mean, what an interesting character. I mean, he must have been, what was he like?
Amazing. So I was growing up, I was a huge Pee-wee Herman fan, like Pee-wee's Playhouse. A friend of mine, you know, my best friend at the time, we would get together every Saturday morning and you know, watch it. Like he, you know, had the old VCR or whatnot, and we'd record them and we'd watch Pee-wee's Playhouse. Just loved it, you know. And so I was a huge fan. And when that came up and I got the opportunity, you know, my agent asked, it's like, hey, would you be interested in, they're doing this new Pee-wee Herman movie. Would you be? And I was like, absolutely.
So
it was like a dream come true for me. I just, you know, so I was super stoked to be able to do that. And Paul's just awesome. He's such a cool guy. So nice. It was a treat to be able to work on that film with him and see him, you know, become that character, you know, right before your eyes, like right there every day we were working together. That was just a real like gift to me, because it's like, I was, you know, such a huge fan. And I felt like, the movie, it was an opportunity to make a Pee-wee Herman style film.
And yeah. What does that mean to you? Pee-wee Herman style?
Well, it's kind of like, there's a certain cartooniness to, you know, like, especially, you know, the Big Adventure movie, which is just brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, it ages so well. It's still like so great. But there's a certain, you know, you're building a world that is not necessary. It's there's a certain kind of broadly drawn, like what I just kind of call like a cartooniness, but I don't mean that in a bad way. It's like, it's a special world. It's Pee-wee's world, you know? And, so everything can be kind of more stylized within the shots. Everything can be brighter. And I usually don't like lighting brighter. you know, it's like, I don't like comedy lighting. That's why normally even most comedies I do, I really try not to do the expected kind of look for a comedy. But, you know, with the Pee-wee movie, it wants to be brighter. You know, it wants to be, have this kind of like a little bit of the gloss and kind of creating a world that is Pee-wee's world. It's not a real world. This is a kind of a special place.
Yeah, there's a certain unrealism to it. And bright and colorful, and you know, a lot of I didn't see the film, but looking at the stills, and it's definitely one I want to see because I'm a Pee-wee fan. Is lots of wide static shots that just like show a crazy thing happening, and it's just such a unique thing. You just brought up a minute ago what I wanted to kind of round our interview out and just complete it with was this idea of lighting and shooting for comedy, because you've done a lot of it. I mean, Eastbound and Down episodes, Pineapple Express. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've done a lot. The Pee-wee movie we just talked about. And what I see across your work and your resume here in portfolio is like you bring a lot of realism, even in situations where realism really doesn't need to be there. You're still able to bring something. And I'd love to just get a little bit of your philosophy for lighting and shooting comedy.
Sure. Well, I kind of fell into shooting more comedy than, you know, I love drama. I much prefer shooting like kind of like in a darker, you know, darker material, you know. To me, it's like the cinematography can just be so much richer because you're really lighting the story. And a lot of times with comedies, I find a lot of times with comedies, you're not lighting the story as much. You're lighting the people. Mm. You know, you're lighting the situation, and you have to make it feel like, oh, this is a, you know, oh, I know what I'm looking at. This is a comedy. I always kind of approach it to where, I think things are funnier when they look more realistic. If, you know, the times where it's like, you know, I'd say it's like the bad versions of, you know, comedy cinematography, the film can be kind of still funny, but when it like is so kind of like flatly and overlit and to fit into this comedy box, because I feel like there's this artificiality that kind of can just get in the way of something, you know, being like funnier. I think it's like the more real you make some of these situations, the funnier the jokes are going to be or the situation is.
Yeah.
Certainly like with Pineapple Express, I think that there's that was certainly part of the approach, but also with that movie, it kind of wanted to feel kind of 80s.
Yeah.
You know, like the more realistic version of like an 80s, you know, comedy. But you know, other ones, it's like I always go into it trying to shoot it more like a drama, and just knowing there are times when you have to know that you can't really shoot it completely like a drama, but you know, so it's a balancing act, you know, that, you know, I've been pretty happy with. And certainly the way, you know, going back to Dickinson, I certainly shoot Dickinson like a drama, even though it's kind of billed as a comedy, but it's, you know, it's got a lot of dark stuff too. So
comedy has evolved so much in the past, you know, 15 years or so. I mean, comedy, all it was before was a laugh track and, you know, a multicam sitcom show with a laugh track. And then slowly but surely, it's like you started seeing shows like Arrested Development that didn't have laugh tracks, and you started seeing camera work that was more handheld. And now you get things like Master of None, which, I mean, how much darker can you get? And it's hilarious and beautiful and excellent. And then the work you're doing on Pineapple Express and all this, it's like, comedy has really changed, and it's amazing. I don't think there's really any other genre that has had such a metamorphosis where horror is still very much still the same. Drama is still the same. Comedy can now be anything.
Yeah. And it's great because it's like I think it's enriched it, and it's like so much of the time just better, you know, it's just so much more interesting. And, you know, and that kind of feeds into the cinematography. It's just making it look more interesting. Hmm. And, you know, it's nice to be able to kind of, whenever you can kind of take chances with something, and it's a great thing to do.
And just lastly, I want to talk about, we've been asking our guests for a while now, what is like the one tool that they have to have with them on all their sets? Curious what you would say to that.
Yeah, that's an easy one for me. It's like, and it's a Leico. And it's an old school light, right? It's, but it is the one light, and I don't always use it. There are times like if there could be a show that I don't use it, I may not use it at all. Or I may just kind of need it a couple of times. But if I only had one light, if I can only choose one light to do an entire film or an entire, it's like I would choose that.
Really?
Because you can do so many things with it. And I will say it is the one thing that light has, and certainly more so in the film days than the digital days, but it still applies. There are so many times where it's like it has bailed me out of like a very difficult lighting situation.
Wow.
And where it's kind of like, oh man, what am I going to do here? It's like, give me a Leico 26 degree barrel right here. Opal in front of the lens. Bring Hampshire too, just in case, you know, and it's, there are times where it's like, it's so versatile. You can kind of like, if you need to, you have no room to hang anything, but maybe you can find a place to bounce a Leico, you know, in a specific corner. And, you know, it's bails you out that way. Or if it's about picking out in a very subtle way, you know, bringing someone out in a really big wide shot. There have just been countless times that I can't tell you how important a piece of gear that's been.
I love that. All right. You're the first to say a Leico light. So there you go. We're always adding to our list here at Go Creative Show of essential DP tools. So thank you. Thank you for bringing something new to it. And thank you for for being on the show and talking about your experiences. Dickinson is awesome. I love it. I saw two episodes. I think it's really, really cool. And I'm psyched that the entire series in its entirety is being released on November 1st on Apple TV Plus. So that is very exciting. Tim Orr, DP.com. You can find him, TimOrrDP.com. Well, the show is great. You guys definitely check out his IMDb and all of his other films. And Tim, can't thank you enough for being on. I really appreciate it. And I'm already looking forward to you coming back for your next project.
Well, great. Well, thanks, Ben. I really enjoyed this.
Here he goes, Tim Orr. Thank you so much for being on the show and sharing your experiences. If you guys haven't seen the show yet, go see it. Now, basically, if you purchased anything from Apple in the past year, pretty much, you get Apple TV Plus for free. So you might as well get on there and see what they have to offer. I also want to thank our producer, Connor Crosby, over at ignitionvisuals.com for putting together a great show, and Matt Russell, who mixes and masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com, gainstructure, and on Twitter, at gainstructure. And when you're on Twitter, tweet us. In fact, find us on all social media platforms because we're there and we want to hear from you. What do you think of the show? Do you have questions for upcoming guests? Do you have guest suggestions? We love hearing from our listeners, so please find us there and let us know what you're thinking. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Shutterstock, Premium Beat, and Hedge. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist, so please support those that support us.